Hey there, vinyl fans. Welcome to another episode of the Vinyl Guide Podcast, the weekly podcast where we cover news, products, and general dialogue for fans and collectors of vinyl records. This week, we are having a special double episode week, which is an exhausting effort that I probably won't be doing again anytime soon. But the episodes are finished, and I'm very proud of them, and I hope you're enjoying them. In today's show, I'll continue the topic of bootleg records. Now, last week, we discussed the history and events that resulted in the very first widely available bootleg, which is a series of unreleased Bob Dylan tracks in a collection called The Great White Wonder. And today, I'll tell the tale of a legendary bootlegger and the methods that he used to capture some of the best rock concerts ever onto tape without permission of the bands or management. Also, I'll talk to Mr. Stephen Coates, an author who just wrote a fascinating book on bootlegging and the various methods used by music lovers in the Soviet Union to traffic songs during the Cold War. The book he wrote is called X-Ray Audio, The Strange Story of Soviet Music on the Bone, and it's brilliant in so many ways. I think you'll all enjoy this discussion and hopefully find yourself buying the book to learn more. Okay, shall we continue with part two in this two-part series?
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
In the previous episode of The Vinyl Guide, I shared the story of how bootleg records started and how quickly they spread. Now, like any industry, once the idea was out there and it was clear there was widespread acceptance, many imitators stepped in and tried to make similar products. And while there are many noteworthy tales about concert bootleggers, I wanted to share one particularly captivating tale of a bootlegger, Mike Millard, or, using the nickname he earned, Mike the Mike. Mike Millard lived in Los Angeles in the 1970s, which just by that fact alone gave him tremendous advantage, as touring bands of the day often played multiple shows in Southern California. Mike was present at some of the most historic concerts America had ever seen, and luckily for us, he was resourceful and committed to capturing these performances on tape. This was a particularly interesting intersection of time, when not only bootleg records were getting quite popular, but also when bands, record companies, and management were completely confused and even fearful of it. Previous to the 70s, the record companies were the only route in which the artist could be heard. So they controlled the faucet, which governed the music the fans had access to. However, starting in the early 70s with bootlegs like Bob Dylan's The Great White Wonder and the Rolling Stones' Liver Than You'll Ever Be, the record companies were admittedly confused, scared, and frustrated. Sometimes this even led to violence. Bootleggers were a great way for band management thugs to take out their aggressions. If the band management discovered a bootlegger taping one of their concerts, the bootlegger was lucky if he got away with only his equipment broken. Case in point, Led Zeppelin's manager Peter Grant and their touring manager Richard Cole were notorious for kicking the crap out of people who were trying to make a buck off Zepp fans by selling unauthorized Led Zeppelin merchandise. If you'd like to see an example of this, just watch the Led Zeppelin movie Song Remains the Same. There's a scene with Peter Grant berating a guy he caught selling posters at a Zepp show. And as crazy as bootleg posters made him, bootleg records drove Peter Grant absolutely mental. And to prove a point that he owned the rights, he would just confiscate them. He would go into record shops that sold bootlegs, grab them off the rack, and simply walk out. Peter Grant was brash, bold, and very dangerous, particularly to anyone who tried to make an unauthorized buck off Led Zeppelin. So taping a Led Zeppelin concert came with a significant risk. In the early 70s, when bootlegs were largely unheard of, concert goers weren't searched very thoroughly. In fact, Dub Taylor, the guy famous for being half the team who compiled the Great White Wonder Dylan bootleg, he taped a Rolling Stones concert in Oakland himself by carrying in an Uhur Report 4000 reel-to-reel tape recorder, which is about the size of two car batteries, carried it into the concert hall, and held a microphone above the crowd pointed directly at the PA system for the entire length of the show. Nobody stopped him, and within weeks, the Rolling Stones bootleg LP, Liver Than You'll Ever Be, was being sold up and down the coast of California. Towards the mid-1970s, concert behavior changed dramatically. Promoters and security were on the lookout for bootleggers, and the crowds were searched and scanned thoroughly before entering the show. And anyone lucky enough to get a tape recorder past the front door wouldn't be able to hold a microphone above the crowd without getting immediately spotted and potentially throttled by a member of the band's road crew. Mike Millard, a music fan living in Los Angeles in the 1970s, wanted to tape the concerts that he saw, but he knew to do it correctly, he needed to invest in some recording equipment. Reel-to-reel tape recorders were out of the question. Although reel-to-reel had some great fidelity, their bulk and potential exposure made them too high risk for the bootlegger. Mike did his research and decided on a Nakamichi 550 cassette tape recorder, which not only gave great sound, but was in a portable package. The Nakamichi 550 wasn't cheap. It was $500 in 1975, but it was the right machine to have if you wanted to make bootleg recordings. In fact, when the tape recorder was reviewed in the August 1975 High Fidelity magazine, the headline of the review was Nakamichi 550, The Pirate's Dream. After spending a small fortune on the ultra-portable Nakamichi 550 tape recorder, Mike now had to figure out how to get the recorder, as well as his microphones and supplies, past the security and into the concerts. His approach to this problem was near genius. Mike bought a wheelchair, strapped the tape deck to the underside of the seat, and pretended to be handicapped while a friend pushed him, unbothered, through the security checkpoints. What gear Mike and his friend couldn't strap to the chair, they had to put in the carry bags. However, cleverly to get past security, Mike would put his soiled underwear on top of the bag. When the security guards would unzip and see this inside the bag, they could only assume that here was this poor handicapped guy who had just shit himself. Most security guards, faced with this option to dig further, understandably declined. Just let the poor kid in to see the band. The security teams would not only let Mike and his accomplice roll on with the tape gear, they'd even put them in a special section right near the front of the stage. It was an ingenious plan that worked every time. When the lights went down, Mike would put the microphones into a special hat he wore to ensure that they pointed well over the crowd as to not capture the noise and start his recorder running. And to control the sound during the show, Mike kept a pocket full of pennies to throw at anyone who made too much noise near his recording area. Mike Millard soon became known as Mike the Mike, and he made high-quality recordings of legendary performances by Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, heaps and heaps of bands, far too many to mention. Between 1974 and 1980, Mike the Mike's main hobby was recording live concerts at the Los Angeles Forum. Hundreds of bands, hundreds of concerts, hundreds of tapes, the majority of extremely high quality. His recordings nowadays are legendary and extremely sought out. In fact, when compiling the Led Zeppelin DVD set in the early 2000s, Jimmy Page personally selected some of Millard's recordings for the menu music. And although Mike the Mike taped most every concert at the LA Forum in the late 70s, he absolutely abhorred bootleggers. He made the concert tapes for himself and his friends to enjoy, not for any monetary gain. Early on, he would share his recordings with close friends, often spending hours decorating the tape packages visually, even including photocopied concert tickets in the cassette dupes. But when he discovered that some of his recordings were turning up on bootleg records, Mike withdrew his generosity. He started marking his tapes, making small fluctuations in the audio to copies he gave his friends. He fiduciously kept track of each of these variations, and if a bootleg ever appeared of one of his recordings, he could tell right away which one of his friends sold him out. Over a few short years, Mike became paranoid and extremely protective of his work. Unfortunately, in the early 80s, Mike's depression began to worsen, and he slowed down his taping activities considerably. In 1990, Mike, perhaps influenced by his condition or medication, went on a rampage and destroyed the majority of his tape collection. That sobering loss made him spiral down even further, and later that year, Mike Millard ended up taking his own life. Very few original Mike the Mike bootleg tapes remain. However, the ones that did survive are incredible. In our Facebook page, facebook.com/vinylguide, I'll post a link to a copy of a Mike Millard recording of A Great Night. It's Led Zeppelin at the LA Forum from June 21st, 1977, a bootleg that became known to be named as Listen to This, Eddie, which was a thumb in the nose to Eddie Van Halen, who reportedly slagged on Jimmy Page at the time in the press. Well, the title, Listen to This, Eddie, was very appropriate because that night Led Zeppelin was in absolute top form. Jimmy Page was right on cue, and John Bonham was having a remarkable night, taking all the right chances behind the drum kit. This concert is a moment in time that was luckily captured by a guy who was ingenious enough to know that one day we'd all thank him for it. Mike Millard was a music enthusiast. He surrounded his life with music, bought tickets and witnessed some of the greatest concerts in history, spent his money on recording gear, formed an ingenious plan to get past security, and risked his limbs to make these recordings that, 40 years later, make us all still smile and groove. Well done, Mike the Mike. Well done, mate. Earlier this week, we released our first of two podcast episodes all about record bootlegging. In part one, we discussed the history and events that resulted in the first widely available bootleg, which was a series of unreleased Bob Dylan tracks in a collection called The Great White Wonder. In that episode, we pointed out that bootlegs were not an attempt to undercut the artist or thwart their ability to make money, but they were a result, a natural reaction for fans who were just wanting more music beyond the material that the artist and the record company were putting out officially. Bootlegs are typically purchased by people who already have all the commercially available product and are simply reacting to the market constraints that are put in place by the artist and record company. Now today in the second part, we're going to explore what happens when these same market constraints exist but are put in place by government forces. Today, we'll speak with Mr. Stephen Coates, a musician and the author of a new book on music in the Soviet Union during the Cold War years, when the Soviet state put severe restrictions on the type of music they allowed their citizens to purchase. These restrictions created a demand for non-approved music, however, at a significant risk to those who dealt and provided non-approved product. Now, before we begin, it would be worth everyone taking a moment to consider your record collection, your music collection, and what you would risk to keep it. Would you risk your freedom to keep listening to the music you love? Would you risk not seeing your family and spending perhaps several years in Siberia for your music? These are real choices that real Soviet citizens made for many years, and many paid a high price. Ultimately, the true story in Stephen's book, X-Ray Audio, The Strange Story of Soviet Music on the Bone, is one of hope and triumph. However, there are many who took the risk and paid the price. It's something to keep in mind when you listen to this interview, and I truly do recommend this book for Vinyl Guide listeners. So to find out more, you could order it from x-rayaudio.com. So with that, let's go to my interview with Stephen Coates, author of the book X-Ray Audio, The Strange Story of Soviet Music on the Bone. All right, I'm speaking over Skype to Mr. Stephen Coates. Now, Stephen is a musician. He's got his band, The Real Tuesday Weld. He does movie soundtracks. I think it'd be fair to say that, Stephen, you have turned the business of making music into a full-time job. You are living the dream, are you not?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it a dream, but I mean, I would describe myself as a jack of many trades, master of some. That's how I describe myself.
Well, that's great. You've been able to balance it all and find that work. I think many around the world, many glasses have been raised in your general direction just on that alone. And what's interesting is what we're talking about today is you've recently added author to your CV. There's a book that Stevens recently put together called X-Ray Audio, The Strange Story of Soviet Music on the Bone. So, Stephen, can you tell us a little bit about this? What led you down this path?
Right. Well, so we've got to rewind the tapes, as it were, for about four or five years ago. And I was in Russia. I'd been going to Russia, or had been going to Russia, to play for about 10 years. And on this particular occasion, we'd played a show in St. Petersburg. And afterwards, the day after, I was wandering in the flea market with a couple of Russian friends and just souvenir-tat shopping as usual. And I came across a stall full of rather strange objects, but one thing in particular caught my eye because it looked like a record, you know, and I'm a record collector, but it also looked like an X-ray. And I asked my Russian friends about it, and young dudes that they are, but they didn't know anything about it at all. The guy whose stall it was rather dismissive. You know, he was much more interested in me buying a furry hat or something. And but I was intrigued. I bought it. I brought it back to London. And it was a record, and it was an X-ray. And that led me on a really extraordinary journey to find out what it was, find out about it. And that journey has, you know, flowered into this book. The Strange Story of Soviet Music on the Bone.
So the music that you found on that single X-ray led you down the path to look for more examples of this sort of medium?
Yeah, so basically what it is, in a nutshell, this was an example of a type of record, flexidisc you might call it, that was made in the Soviet Union between about 1946 and 1964. And it was music which was recorded onto used X-ray film. And the reason that it was recorded onto used X-ray film was because it was in an era in the Soviet Union when a lot of music was forbidden. Now, Western music was forbidden for sort of obvious Cold War reasons. You know, we, the Western countries, or the Western cultures, rock and roll, jazz and all that was the music of the enemy at that time. So that was forbidden in the Soviet Union. But of course, people had heard it. They'd heard snippets of it. They'd heard it during the war, for sure. They knew about it, you know, bits. You could catch snatches on the radio. So young people in particular wanted that music. But then also, you had a lot of Russian music that was forbidden. And that was, you know, some of it had been made by people before the war who were huge stars. But they had become forbidden because either because they were emigres, they didn't live in the Soviet Union anymore, which meant that you were effectively a traitor, or because it was in a style which the government, Soviet government, had come to regard as unhelpful, should we say. And that included a huge amount of Russian music, which was very popular. So you've got a situation where you've got a whole culture which is being restricted from what they can listen to, and the only way to get at that music, to play it, was to create a bootleg culture, as that's what we would say, illegal recordings. And also, unlike the West in, say, you know, the States or Australia or the UK, you couldn't get access to the normal means of production, you know, pressing plants and all that stuff. I mean, bootleggers in the US, for instance, you know, privately used commercial pressing plants to make bootleg records. That was impossible in the Soviet Union because the recording industry was completely controlled by the state. So the bootleggers who started in Leningrad, St. Petersburg, as we say, after the war, they had to devise their own means of doing it. And they used recording lathes, which is not like a press, it's more like a gramophone in reverse, to write these records one by one. And they used X-ray film, because as it happens, X-ray film could take the groove of an audio signal and reproduce it in, you know, reasonable fidelity. Plus, X-rays were in abundance because the Soviet government had given an instruction that they had to be destroyed after a year because they were flammable. So you had a situation where you had people in the hospitals had to get rid of their x-rays, and these bootleggers wanted to use them to make records on.
So it was a natural exchange there then. The hospitals were looking to get, I guess the x-rays with the material that was made, is that like a silver nitrate?
Yeah, it's exactly. It was a silver nitrate, sort of nitrocellulose base, sort of soft, flexible film. I mean, it didn't have to be x-ray film. You know, you can record on other types of plastic. And in fact, they did, actually. It's just that x-rays happened to be plentiful and easily available.
And if the authorities came in to search your house and they found a stack of x-rays, that wouldn't be something that they would necessarily question, not looking specifically close to, onto the x-ray to see the actual grooves.
Well, I think what happened pretty quickly, actually, is that the authorities did catch on. I mean, this started, as far as I'm able to tell, through, you know, I spent 3 years, well, not the entire time, but I researched this story over 3 or 4 years in Russia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where it's really a secret history even now, it's not widely known. And from what I'm able to tell was that it started amongst a small group of people, sort of, you know, music lovers, actually, mm-hmm. who were also technically skilled in recording techniques. But it spread quite quickly because, you know, as people realized, wow, you know, we can hear this sort of music. So, as of course, as it spread, the authorities got wind of it. And really, from about 1950, attempted to suppress it. And some of the, we'd say, bootleggers, you know, the people who were making these records, ended up in prison.
So your book is visually stunning. And I would really encourage everyone to, even while they're listening to it, to check out the website, x-rayaudio.com. There you can see what the book looks like. You can see actual examples of the x-rays that were used as records, as well as a lot of other materials that they used besides x-rays. So what other materials were made during that time that were used for this type of audio distribution?
Well, really, they would use all sorts of things. I mean, I've got some stuff, and you think, God, what is that? You know, it looks like a sort of wrapping from a pizza or something, you know. They used various sort of photographic films, some things which looked like they came from, you know, laboratories. They were industrial-type plastics, really anything they could get their hands on. And my colleague, Alex Kolkowski, who works with us on this project, he's an expert in this kind of recording, and you know, one of the things that we do, we have live events where, you know, I tell the story of this, the bootleggers. And then in the second part, Alex will cut a new x-ray record live from a musical performance. And, you know, he has made many experiments onto different types of plastics. Some, you know, are just really suitable for taking it. And it can be anything. I mean, he knows of people, this is much later, and this is in the UK, who've made records on road signs. Really, if it's got a plastic surface and it will take a groove, you can use it to record music.
So in the post-war era, these sort of record cutters were not too uncommon. In fact, I think they were used for communication or for people mailing messages to loved ones. Any particular examples that you found in your travels of Russia of those sort of usages of that that media?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in fact, the third part of the image section of the book is devoted to what, you know, are called broadly called audio postcards, or some people call them sound cards. And there's many examples, actually. You can see some on the X-ray Audio site, actually. Mm-hmm. And they were the same sort of stuff. They were sort of commercially made blanks, often with a picture on them of some tourist scene or occasionally, you know, of some MiG fighters or something. And, you know, you could go into a shop and use one of these recorders. Voiceograph is an example, of course, in the States, famously. And you could use a microphone to record, a message to the folks back home if you were in a tourist resort. You know, I've got one here, which is an American Marine Corps one from Korea. You know, it was made for the Marines so that they could send a message to mom, you know, or to a loved one. And in the Soviet Union, of course, what happened is that they had these machines too. This came a bit later, really, than the X-ray era. But, of course, in the Soviet Union, they used these discs. You know, what was supposed to happen was that you would go into a shop and you would order a Soviet pop tune, you know, on one of these discs and add your message to your mum at the front of it. Of course, what they did was is that they used the blanks to record Rolling Stones, Beatles, you know, anything else and sold those instead. You know, you could probably buy those out of hours. So that became another source of bootlegging.
In your travels and in finding these sort of X-ray discs, let's just say, how much of it was Western music being bootlegged and how much of it was Russian music?
The majority is Russian. I mean, often, you know, it's said about these records that they were sort of, you know, it was all about jazz and rock and roll. It wasn't actually. I mean, jazz and rock and roll appeared on them for sure, but the majority of them seem to have been Russian music. And, you know, which in a way is much more poignant because, you know, you had a culture here that was cut off from its own culture. And, you know, it's a bit like, you know, say in the UK, well, suddenly being told that, you know, you can no longer listen to the Beatles because this is music often that had been immensely popular before the war. You know, tangos by Pyotr Ilyushenko, you know, he was a huge pop star effectively, but he fell out of favor, he became forbidden, and so people weren't allowed to listen to it. And, you know, you can imagine what that was like. So most of the records that we found are Russian, yeah.
What sort of music would have been forbidden during this period of time in Russia?
Well, apart from the Western stuff, which is easy to understand, and music made by what they call emigre Russians. So this is Russians who had left either during and after the revolution or during the Second World War and had gone to Western Europe usually, but, you know, carried on making records there. So their repertoire became forbidden. Nothing to do with whether it was anti-Soviet. It was just the fact that they hadn't returned to the Soviet Union. So they were regarded as traitors. So all their repertoire was forbidden, even if they were singing about the nobility of the working classes, you know. But then inside Russia, a huge genre of music was forbidden, which is broadly called blatny. And it really, that means a sort of urban folk, sort of gritty songs about the underclass, songs about criminals, songs about, you know, wild passions, songs that were very popular actually in the Gulag system, you know, and you have to, millions of Russians were in the Gulag system. So sometimes these songs are called prison songs or Gulag songs, and they were very, very popular. But of course, the Soviet authorities didn't want them recorded because they showed the dark side of socialist realism. So, you know, they became a prime thing for these bootleggers to cut onto X-ray.
Now, you also speak in the book about the musicians who were perhaps living alternative lifestyles. They were also cut off from any sort of musical distribution or any sort of say in the culture of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean, a sort of prime example would be Vadim Kozin, who was a Russian Soviet pop star, effectively. Particularly before the war, he was hugely popular. And, you know, sang in the Kremlin, you know, sang for the troops at the front. Everybody loved him. And then he was arrested for being homosexual and sent to the Gulag. Now, of course, they'd known he was homosexual for years. He wasn't really arrested for being homosexual. He was arrested probably because he'd fallen out of favor, you know, with one of the Soviet upper command for some reason, or maybe they thought he was getting too big for his boots, or, you know, some political reason, probably.
Perhaps they couldn't control him.
I think that's probably right, actually. I mean, there's recently been a program about him, actually, narrated by Mark Almond, you know, as in Soft Cell Mark Almond, who's a big fan. And, you know, what it says is that Vadim Kozin, yeah, he'd sort of become maybe too big, too popular, too rich, and they decided, you know, that it was time to bring him down. So his homosexuality was used as the reason. And of course, he was sent to the Gulag. It's an absolutely tragic story. And his records, you know, they didn't make any more of his records. I mean, so they still existed, of course, because people had already bought them, and they didn't go around people's houses collecting them. But they didn't make any more, and so you get his music on X-ray too.
And you also mentioned that there were specific types of music, not just content in the lyrics, but genres of music that were forbidden simply because of how the state interpreted them.
Well, yes. So from the classic thing is tango, you know, or mambo. South American rhythms, you know, were seen as unhelpful. They were seen as sort of encouraging unwelcome passions in young people. They had a sensuality or sexuality to them, which encouraged people to dance. And, you know, now that to us, that seems absolutely bonkers. You know, why would you ban the foxtrot, you know, as a rhythm? But this was a different time. You know, this was a time when all the culture of the Soviet Union was supposed to be in the service of the ideals of socialist realism. So you've got a culture where, you know, if you created, if you wrote a book, if you wrote a play, if you made a film and, you know, wrote a song, it was meant to be helping this great march forward. So this kind of these rhythms, which were just really about dancing and about love, and, you know, they were regarded as being unhelpful. And of course, they were foreign as well, which is another reason. So they became banned. But listen, the saxophone was banned for a while. You know, some people think that was a good idea.
You know, sometimes I hear a Kenny G album and, you know.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. If you heard Kenny G,
I understand.
So saxophones were banned. I mean, or straightened out. I mean, at least I don't know if this is an apocryphal story, but apparently they were straightened out. I don't know if you can actually do that to a saxophone, but the kinks were straightened out. It was a strange time.
So in the Soviet Union at this time, how did the bootleggers get their hands on the equipment to make these X-ray records?
Well, you know, we talked a little bit about these commercial recording machines that you could get in the West. And, you know, the Voicegraph was the sort of American famous one. Well, somebody brought, a Polish guy brought one of these machines into Leningrad after the war. He'd probably got it in Berlin or in Germany. It was a war trophy. It had probably been a German model which had been used by a war reporter to make recordings of news, you know, from the front during the war onto some commercial plastic disc to be sent back to, you know, German radio. Anyway, this guy had got hold of one, and agile as ever in the Soviet Union, you know, started to use it to make recordings of forbidden gramophone records. And he actually had an official business. He was supposed to be just using it for novelty recordings, really. But of course, after hours, he started to make bootlegs. And really, what happened is that the bootleg culture spread from there, because people started to copy this machine, make their own versions of it, with different degrees of success. Some people were really good at it, and, you know, the records that they made were pretty high quality, you know, and others, you know, who just really did it for the money, you know, the sound quality could be terrible. It's a difficult process. When Alex, my colleague, you know, we do it live, you see how difficult it actually is to do. And these machines were not easy to build. You needed a lot of engineering skill to build them and set them up. You know.
And how long would an X-ray record last? How many spins typically?
Well, particularly at the beginning, when this was an era when you're still using old-fashioned gramophones, hand-pumped, they would actually probably last about 10 plays, if that. You know, the steel needle would tear them to pieces. When electric stylus came, which they did in the Soviet Union in the 50s, like they did in the West, you know, you could get many more plays out of them. But they were sort of disposable, really. They weren't built to last, you know.
So let's say we were back in the late 50s in the Soviet Union. How would we procure some of these X-ray records?
Right. Well, I mean, they were effectively dealt in the way that drugs are dealt. That's probably the best analogy. You know, I don't know how it is in Sydney, and I'm not claiming any personal experience here, but, you know, if you want to buy some weed in London, you know, you either do it through a friend, you know, which is obviously tried and tested, or, you know, you go out somewhere and there's a place where you can meet a dealer, you know, and it was pretty much like that, actually. If you didn't know a friend who could sort you out, then there were places in the cities, certain courtyards, certain street corners, certain squares in the park where the dealers would gather, and you could go there and, you know, an exchange could be made. They were pretty cheap, these things, and it was a bit hit and miss from what I understand from my research. You know, it wasn't like going to a record store and, you know, flicking through the the choices and making, you know, picking a particular song or artist. It was, you know, you could ask for rock and roll or you could ask for tango. You could maybe ask for a particular song, but, you know, whether you actually got it or not was uncertain. And then, you know, a bit of money would be exchanged and a sort of one of the dealers would pull out one of these discs from his sleeve because they were flexible. And that's it. You'd go home and play it and hope that you got something worth listening to.
Continuing on with your metaphor, was it like buying weed or was it like buying a handgun?
I think it more like buying weed. I mean, I think, you know, the dealers, you know, risked punishment. And of course, you know, I've met a bootlegger who went to prison. You know, the authorities really stamped on them. If you were just a kid and you bought one of these records, you're caught buying it, or, you know, you had it at home, you would be reprimanded, and, you know, you'd kind of get in hot water, but, you know, it wouldn't be like having bought a gun, you know, where you'd be in serious, serious trouble. You know, it wasn't as serious as that from the buyer's point of view. It's much more risky if you're a dealer or a bootlegger.
Mm. And how much did these records typically cost? Like, what percentage of maybe a monthly wage would one of these X-ray audio records cost?
Well, they were cheap. They were cheap. I mean, it's probably better to look at the other way around. What would it cost you to buy a gramophone record, bona fide gramophone record of, you know, say, Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock? Probably a month's wages, even if you could find such a thing. You know, somebody'd smuggle one in, you could buy it a month's wages. Whereas these things were, you know, probably like for us, you know, buying a normal bit of vinyl, you know, I mean, single or an LP, you know, you're talking about saving up your pocket money to, you know, or saving up your lunch money and buying one a week or something, you know, not a great expenditure compared with the official stuff.
How many of these records have you found?
I'm collecting. I've probably only got about 40 or 50. What we're much more interested in with the X-ray audio project is photographing them. I mean, so when I've been in Russia and, you know, in the book and on the website, you know, what we do is if we come across them, we find, you know, somebody's got one or got a few, we photograph them. And really, one of the things we've been trying to do is to create an archive, you know, take an image of them if we can get the sound off them, you know, so that they're there in memory, you know. I have got a sort of small collection over the years, but I'm more than anything, really, we're interested in recording them and recording the stories about them.
Preserving them, yeah. It's more of a historical sort of record.
It
at
is,
this point.
Really, yeah. I mean, that's what we're trying to do. And, we're very keen. One of the things about the website is that, you know, we're keen for people to get in contact if they've got stories or snippets of information about them, you know. And that's been really amazing, actually, because I've been on tour with this thing. You know, I've given talks on it in the States and in Europe, and you know, people then get in touch and say, "Oh, my granddad, you know, had one of these," and send me pictures and stuff. And that's really what we're trying to do, is to sort of make a repository of them. You know,
the book is quite intriguing because it not only shows these examples, these pictures that you have, which are they're beautiful, they're like art. If I had one of these, I would have no problem hanging it on the wall. It's cool and creepy, you know, and very interesting all in one. The book also tells the story of how these came to be, of how the original lathe came in from Poland, and how it was then copied and distributed, and how multiple lathes were then created from old phonograph parts. So it's not just an eye candy. It's not just a book to flip through and see the pictures, but it also tells a really interesting and true story about how human innovation always finds a way.
I think so. And I mean, you know, I think as far as we're able to know at the moment, this book tells the entire history of these records. I mean, there are more stories and more facts to come, but broadly, it was a small thing. It was a small, you know, bit of audio history during the Cold War. It lasted for about 18 years. And it, for me, it's fascinating on many fronts, for sure, but in a way, the most powerful emotional aspect of it is that it's a story about people who really loved music and took, in the bootlegger's case, took some significant risk of imprisonment to copy and spread the music that they loved. Now, for sure, it became black market business later on. But the people at the beginning, really, they did it because they loved music and they felt that they should be able to listen to what they wanted to, when they wanted to, with who they wanted to, and that other people should too. And it's a story of human endeavor, you know, of human agility to overcome technical problems to reach that end. And I think in a way that's the most moving thing, particularly, you know, we live in an age, Nate, when you know, we have complete abundance in musical terms. We've all got thousands, ten thousands of songs, or access to anything we want as soon as we want. And, you know, I'm a musician myself, and I love all that. But, you know, I do wonder, you know, what does a particular song mean anymore? You know, how much does it weigh? How much does it matter? And this story is a story of a time when music mattered so much that people were prepared to go to prison for it.
It's wonderful, and it's humbling hearing just that this is what happened. And I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us and really capturing this very interesting story, this interesting bit of audio history in this book, and sharing it with our listeners. Our listeners are very much into vinyl and all the different bits that go into playing these bits of plastic or vinyl that we have. And, you know, we get to be a bit nerdy sometimes talking about the differences and the variation, but this is a whole different kind of segment of that. This is a whole different alternate universe when it comes to you know, vinyl collecting, and the fact that you know, if you were caught, then you risked everything for what you love. So it really is a wonderful story, and I encourage everyone to check out the website x-rayaudio.com. Look at the visuals of the book and order one, because it is absolutely beautiful to have and to see the life-size, high-resolution images of what these records look like. It really is an incredible effort. I want to thank you very much, Stephen.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, that concludes our special double episode week here on the Vinyl Guide Podcast. Talked all about bootleg records. Hope you guys learned a lot here and had some fun. I do want to thank Mr. Stephen Coates, the author of X-Ray Audio. Everyone, please go to x-rayaudio.com. Check out the book. Buy a copy for yourself and a friend. It really is an awesome book. Also, check out his band, The Real Tuesday Weld. Really interesting stuff he's doing there. So thanks again, Stephen. Also, Mike the Mike, Ken Douglas, Dub Taylor, for just existing and doing what you did for the bootleg industry. That was awesome. I do want to also thank Marilyn Adams, who pointed me in the direction and helped me research some of this episode. Thank you so much, Marilyn. That was way, way cool. Special thanks to John Sanders, a.k.a. Doug Steele, for all the voiceovers. Special thanks to Chuck, really, for your endless support, man. I really love you. Of course, my family, for all the patience while I sit in front of the computer and make these things. Also, big ups to all the people that are giving great reviews for this podcast on Apple iTunes. Those go a long way. They really do. And if you guys enjoy this podcast, you want to do something nice for me, go to Apple iTunes, sign in, give us a good review. That would be heaps awesome. And also, really, just thanks to all the listeners who have been supporting this podcast by listening to it and telling all their friends. This concludes our double episode week here on The Vinyl Guide. I'm pretty tired. I may take a week off, but don't worry. I'll be back shortly with a heap of new episodes and vinyl stories to share. In the meantime, join our Facebook page, facebook.com/vinylguide. And until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.